philosophers who can lay the theoretical groundwork for new types and ways of thinking about the universe and nature before the actual scientific community can step in and do the actual work that would follow that paradigm, or that new paradigm. So you need thinkers that aren't dealing strictly with the scientific model in order to think outside the box and come up with new revelations for us to get to work on. So that's all. K-A-T-T.
PhD with a comment.
Yes, Jim.
I was going to leave this alone, but to comment on what's the last couple of minutes. The confluence of invention, discovery, and current events today leads you to an interesting character. His name is Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. I can say again, Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. He speaks to a lot of the things that have been talked about the last couple of minutes. Today's discussions don't really hold much water unless you hear what some of the current drivers of thought are thinking. So I suggest you look into this guy, his books, his speeches, his opinions, his followers. Dr. Yuval Noah Harari. I'll leave it at that. I'll make no comment on what his thoughts are. Thanks. Good job to everybody, Roy. I enjoyed it immensely.
By the way, Roy, the quibbling over semantics, hopefully it has been left behind with the 20th century analytic philosophers.
Okay. And I'm not taking any side. This is just something that comes from, you know, from within me. So keep it very simple.
Okay. Okay, and to Xian. I have a very simple and funny to me question. Radio frequencies are always higher than those of sound. Is it a misconception? What's the problem with it? What's the difference between radio frequencies and sound? So we have two questions. And to Xian, Dr. Roy.
Okay, not quite sure what the point here is, but acoustic frequencies are sort of limited by the medium they have to exist in, whereas since there isn't the luminiferous either, electromagnetic waves can radiate from a fraction of a hertz to very high frequencies, whereas acoustic signals have some limitation. They could go up into the kilohertz. I don't think practically they would be sustainable in an atmosphere of air in the megahertz and the gigahertz and such. So I don't know. I doubt that that's exactly what you're looking for.
WB2EAV may have an answer.
Certainly, Ed.
Ultrasonics covers, you know, acoustics up into way above human hearing. As far as the radio side, back when I was a kid, I don't think they're still running it. The Navy ran radio station NAA, which transmitted tremendous amounts of power at 14 kilohertz to communicate with submerged submarines. But it was RF at a frequency of 14 kilohertz.
KA2UTF with an ultrasonic background.
Okay, Gary?
Well, I'll tell you, which you probably know, Roy, in medical applications, we're using frequencies, I think, going up to 30 megahertz now. And interestingly, once I was downstate playing with some of the earliest ultrasound technology, and we were looking for a retinal detachment in a human eyeball. And when I switched, I didn't see anything. It looked like a normal eyeball at 15 megahertz. When I switched to 20, there was a total retinal detachment. So that's interesting from the medical point of view, that diagnosis was so resolution dependent. We actually published an article on it.
Yeah, the nature of my two questions was, radio frequencies are always higher than those of sound. True or false? Is it a misconception? The second one, what is the difference between radio frequencies and sound? Dr. Roy.
Well, thought I answered it before. I'll answer it again. I just mentioned to Gary that I was specifically speaking of acoustic in the air. So I'm curious to see at what point do ultrasonics sort of break down in an air media versus a tissue and a liquid one in the human body. There's got to be some upper a limit just on the physicality of air molecules. The second question, what's the difference? Basically, the medium. One is a fluctuation in the local electromagnetic field, and the other are pressure waves of atmosphere.
Yeah, my 5 cents to it. Energy that is sound, ultrasound, super high frequency sound is a mechanical wave. It's a longitudinal wave. Has nothing to do with electromagnetic wave and never had. And there is no origin that could actually put them those two together. The electromagnetic wave is the wave that has nothing to do with longitudinality. It's a transversal electromagnetic wave and has two factors, the electric field and magnetic field in it, which actually sound wave doesn't have. And they do exist in the same medium, but are not affected by the same medium. So we have air. Let me drop.
I have a thought experiment.
Yeah, and I can comment knowledgeably on some of that.
Okay, 1 second. Let me see if I have it. Okay, before we diverge, that's not a good definition. Well, again, we're getting into nomenclature. You're saying that something is a radio wave because it's defined as a radio wave, or a sound wave because it's defined as a type of a sound wave. So it's kind of circular logic. But nevertheless, in the vacuum of space, you can have an electromagnetic wave propagating. You cannot have an acoustic wave propagating, despite the episodes of Star Trek recently.
Well, I do agree. But we could have the same medium, and we could have both. The mechanical wave, which is the sound wave, and electromagnetic wave, which is the transversal wave, in the same medium. But not always in every medium, and to exist.
Okay, Ed, you wanted to say something, and then we'll go to Gary?
Yeah, here's a thought experiment. Take a large public address speaker, like, you know, for an outdoor stadium, and just feed in a really annoying single frequency tone to deafen everybody. And then what you do is you remove the wires from the loudspeakers and hook them up. Let's say it's at 5 kilohertz. And you hook them up instead to a dipole antenna that resonates at 5 kilohertz. We're talking like 10 miles long or something. I believe that would radiate as an RF field as long as it was resonant at 5 kilohertz. But I haven't done the math. I'm guessing 10 miles long.
I agree. There is no limitation for... There is no limitation for the frequency of radio waves, and no limitation for the frequency of a lower part of the sound wave. So you could have a few hertz electromagnetic wave. As a matter of fact, submarines use 5 kilohertz, 3 kilohertz, 17 kilohertz and more, and you could really have a good electromagnetic communication. Now, the antenna doesn't have to be miles away. It could be electrically short antenna, and it's mostly done on ferrites. Remember the radios we had in the 70s, 60s? They had a ferrite antenna, and it was very small, but the radio was able to react to the electromagnetic waves and to exceed.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John, recognize, I just want to get to Gary first, and then you'll go, okay?
Okay, well, just quickly, of course, sound wave is a mechanical disturbance in a medium, and it's propagated in that fashion. And when we shock excite a piezoelectric ultrasonic crystal and apply it to a medium, what is formed after the phasing and reinforcing of the spherical wavelets that are emitted from the transducer face
is a longitudinal plane wave front. That's true, but depending on what it's crossing through, like bone, compact bone, it may turn into a shear wave, you know. So that's my basic comment. You know, it is a mechanical wave. That's true. But that, like you said, that's the definition of sound. KA2UTF.
Okay, very good, Gary. John, you wanted to say something?
Oh, and air is 100% reflective.
Okay, yeah. I think everybody hit it right on the head. It really depends on the mode of propagation. A sound is propagated as a compressional wave, whereas radio is propagated as an electromagnetic wave. You mentioned longitudinal wave, but I think you can have an acoustic wave which is also shear, a shear wave, in that the movement is at right angles to the direction of propagation, such as an earthquake wave. I think there are earthquake waves that are shear as well as longitudinal. But again, there's a lot of examples of low frequency, very low frequency radio frequency signals. The old Omega navigation system, which was done away with, that Alexander alternator that they fire up every couple of times a year at 17.8 kilohertz. You hook a speaker to that. I guess you will, if your hearing is good, be at the upper limit of your hearing. But again, it all depends on how it's propagated. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, John. Wesley, any closing comments before we close this segment and move on to the next one?
And Q on you.
Yeah. There is another person. I have a little problem with the shear wave. The shear wave, transverse wave, that occurs in elastic medium when it is a subject to periodic shear, and that might not be qualified as a transverse electromagnetic wave. So it has definitely mechanical property in it. But I'm open to all of the suggestions. And to Jean, and there was a person who wanted to comment.
Yeah, I don't think anyone suggested that shear waves were electromagnetic in quality, simply that they're not longitudinal in direction under those circumstances. John, NQ1U, what comments did you want to make?
Yeah, please correct me. I have this concept that the thing that makes electrons in a wire able to send out an RF wave is the fact that the frequency of the alternating current in the conductor is fast enough that the magnetic field doesn't have enough time to collapse, and it has to be radiated, which would mean you could have the longest antenna in the world and have a 1 hertz signal and you would never get a radio wave. Is that true?
And to exist. We actually don't care about collapse time. All we care is a rate of change in time frame. So if we have rate of change in time frame or a frame of magnetic field, we have electromagnetic waves and reverse. That's all right.
Okay, let me see that I have it. Ah, very good. Okay. You want the collapse. Basically, what's going on is you're inducing electric and magnetic fields, Ampere's law, Faraday's law, and the two are irradiating away. The curl of the vector is radiating away from the radiating antenna. Now, my million-dollar question that I cannot find any place is, these rules allow antennas to radiate in quadrature mode. In other words, the magnetic peak is the electric potentials zero point and vice versa. So they're 90 degrees out of phase with each other in the near field. Somewhere between the near field and the far field, all the electromagnetic waves go from quadrature sync to full time sync, so that they're both peaking and valleying at the same time.
Kind of confused, because you started the way we want the field to collapse. That's what you started with. So Could you explain that again?
You want the electronic, you want the circuit to collapse across the antenna because it's the change in the electric field that induces a magnetic field, and the change in the magnetic field that induces the electric field that go off as electromagnetism. So if you had a wave that was just, well, it wouldn't be a wave, it would be just a solid current, nothing would be emitted. Once you have fluctuations, especially in a standing wave antenna, in which the peaks and valleys are synchronized, so they reinforce each other harmonically like a storage site and bleed off the electric and magnetic fields, you want a change. So I don't know where I lost you.
The computer starts from the point of you want the field to collapse. No, you want the rate of change. You have a DC current in the clouds, and then you have the moment when the lightning is hitting the earth, and then you have that part of the heating is AC. It's no longer DC. Is it collapsing or is it expanding? So if we take the full period, 360 degrees, and now we try to analyze the first quarter of the period, it's just rate of change in the time frame. And that's electromagnetic wave as well. Doesn't have to be collapsing. It's just rate of change. And the rate of change of magnetic field creates rate of change of electric field. And there you go. You have electromagnetic wave. And do exchange.
If you pulse the old transmitters that just use spark gaps basically were harmonic rich objects. Basically, the square wave was just generating an endless stream of harmonic signals. So again, you could either say it collapsed, or you could say that it reached zero, which any wave does twice in a cycle. So, again, unfortunately, we're veering terribly close to semantics here.
Semantics rears its head again.
I believe you're right. That's right. The subject reached the limitation of my ability to express my point in English, but based on what you say, you're right. The only thing is that I wanted to point at the rate of change in time frame, not the physical collapsing or expanding.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John. By the way, Wesley, you doubled with me, so I wasn't able to mention to Gary that we're always going to have semantic disagreements, unfortunately. I can't see any way human beings living without that foible. But, John, you want to say something?
Yeah, I think getting back to the original question the gentleman had was, what frequency? Well, any time-varying electric field will generate a magnetic field, and any time-varying magnetic field will generate an electric field. That's the coupling with Maxwell's equation. So any time-varying current will produce some radiation. It could be at 1 hertz, 10 hertz, several kilohertz, or up in the gigahertz. As I say, there are many very low-frequency signals that are used for specialized communications. And the very fact that it's time-varying, I mean, like ignition noise, you get the click, click, click of ignition noise when the spark fires because there's a very rapid change in the current. But it is the time varying that does the radiation.
Great answer. Thanks.
Yeah, great answer. That was what I was trying to say. I just didn't have the right words to express it. Dr. Ray?
Okay, I agree, John. It's a good answer. Let me just throw, unfortunately, some blue sky physics. Totally theoretical, and don't worry your head about it. But if Planck measurement is real, if space and time actually are granular, that they're not ultimately analog, contiguous. Then there is a minimum time, a Planck second, and a minimum distance, a Planck distance. If you then describe an electromagnetic wave whose wavelength is shorter than a Planck length, or whose period is shorter than a Planck second, then theoretically, I guess, according to quantum mechanics, it's a meaningless concept. So just something to roll around in your head.
Yeah, that's the idea that time is actually quantized, right? I think, isn't that the time it takes light to cross a hydrogen atom or something like that?
I forget the constructs, but it's much smaller than that. So it's so many orders of magnitude smaller than anything we could measure that I can't see anyone being able to demonstrate this anywhere in the next century, but you never know. But yeah, the concept is the ultimate quantization of space-time itself, that when you get down to a certain level where there's just quantum foam, you can't get shorter than a Planck length, and things can't happen less than a Planck second. But I don't really remember offhand what were the units, how they came up with that conclusion. But it's an interesting concept. Anyway, any closing statements before we move on to the SpaceNet?
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
There's a English scholar who was of Indian descent, talks about reality and knowledge, and he talks about concepts. Once a person has a concept, then he believes is no longer reality. This person, very interesting to study, and I read a lot of his books, and I don't usually read so many books. Back to you.
ACUCL for the comment on duration.
Yes, Gary.
Yeah, it's a very interesting philosophical question, Planck instant and all that. But same thing in terms of what is change. In other words, when does something cease being what it is and become something else, other than what it was? In other words, where's the whither and the when? What is the actual instant in which the transformation takes place? In other words, there has to be an instant that has no measurable duration in time. It's almost very important epistemologically and metaphysically in order for there to be experience at all.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, and in addition, a lot of times it's a good idea to conceive of the speed of light in a vacuum, C, as the actual speed of causality. It's the velocity that causality spreads out from its origin point.
Yeah, it could be the actual occurrence, or it could be a recording of that occurrence.
You know, infinite and the infinitesimal have to merge at some point, or not be different from one another. In other words, the nature of difference and sameness is a philosophical question underpinning all this. But okay, we won't get. I'm not getting lost in the weeds. I don't need to do that. KACUCL.
-44 seconds.
Occurrence in time and space, or it can be a recording of that occurrence, like, for example, in a book.
Let me see if I have it this time. Okay, very good. Someone broke in, I think, to give us a Planck second of 10^-44. I didn't have a chance to Google it. I think we're kind of deep into the weeds. I thank everyone for this interesting philosophical scientific discussion, and please come back next week when we'll try and do something similar all over again and, you know, solve all the problems for the universe. You know, what the hell with just the planet Earth? when we can have the multiverse. Nevertheless, I want to thank everyone. Don't want to waste too much time because we've already delayed the SpaceNet report. So I'll be back a little bit later. Here's Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
HPGS WS2N. Very good. Roy, great topic tonight. Before I go on, I wanted to mention that Ed is going to be, WB2EAB is going to be doing a presentation for Limelock, and that would be this Wednesday. I believe Ed is still on frequency. He can confirm that. I'm sure that hasn't changed. But it's supposed to be all about our receivers or receivers, you know, technology involved with receivers. Ed, are you still out there? WB2EAB, WS2N. Well, I heard him before, but anyway, that's the latest. And what you would do is, it's either in person or on Zoom. And, you know, you could get your Zoom credentials by going to your Limelock, Limelock webpage, limelock.org. I heard that before, right, Roy?
Yeah, he was, you know, he moves indoors and outdoors, so he might have put the HT down for a while.
Okay, very good. Anyway, the club meeting always starts around 7:30, and usually presentations come on at 8 and last about an hour. And, of course, if you can't make it, you could always go to the Limelock channel. The YouTube channel. You know, sometime afterwards, whenever they get around to, they always record these things, and then they'll put them on the Limelock YouTube channel, and it will be there probably forever. So, very good. Yeah, as far as the SpaceNet report, yeah, we have a couple of not as many topics as normally, but. Couple of important ones. First one involved the SLS Artemis 1 program. Probably talk about this last couple of weeks. The goal last week was to completely test the vehicle itself out at Launch Complex 39B. So they rolled it all the way out to that complex from the VAB building, the Vehicle Assembly Building. And the idea was to test all the electronics, everything, right down to 10 seconds before liftoff, and then they won't do it because this is only a test. Launch would be May. It looks like June now. But the idea is to make sure everything works. So they want to completely load it up with cryogenically cooled liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. That's the main fuel for the SLS rocket system. Yeah, the core section that's going to be driven by four RS-25 engines. They're the engines that same engines that we used on the shuttle. Three engines that you always saw on the bottom of the shuttle when it was going up. You know, not the solid boosters. The that's different. Of course, they're solid fuel boosters that are mounted on the port side and the starboard side of the core section. And also the second stage above the core stage is also liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen as well. And that runs a different engine, RL-10 by Aerojet. And that one puts out around, I think, 25,000 pounds of thrust, where the four engines on the bottom of the core section, they're around roughly around 500,000 pounds each. You see, team that up with the two boosters, and that would be what, 3.5 and 3.5 on a solid booster. So you lifting off around 8.5 million pounds of thrust, which is a lot more than the Saturn V rockets that they use to launch everybody to the moon and also Skylab. So, you know, they brought everything out. They rolled it out. It took 11 hours to get out there, and then a couple of days before they started testing. And actually, a day or two before testing, they had a lot of lightning at the launch site. You know, Florida gets a lot of lightning. And they have these big towers up that span around the rocket, four big towers. And then they run cables from each tower. So if lightning comes down, it's going to hit one of the towers. Well, during this lightning storm, they got four hits. And one of it was right on a catenary wire, you know, between one of the towers. So actually, that was a good test to make sure the lightning system worked. And nothing affected the rocket itself. And then time went on. They wanted to start fueling, and they realized one of the helium valves were not opening at all. And they realized that there's a problem with that. After checking, going into it, they need to be able to open certain valves. When you fill a system, any kind of a tank, something has to be temporarily opened for fluid to flow. So apparently that's going to be a problem, and they're going to work on that. And also they had positive airflow problems within the structure itself, the launch complex tower itself. You have a lot of areas that are sealed off, where you can walk through. You got elevators. All these things have to have a positive air pressure inside, in case there's any kind of fumes leaking outside when you're filling. You don't want it, hydrogen and oxygen things to get inside the confined spaces. Well, the fans that create that positive pressure apparently were not working properly. They worked on that. They fixed that. And they call this a wet dress rehearsal for the launch. So they got pretty far, but not quite far enough. And then they had another launch from Launch Complex 39A, which is very close to B, and they stood down on the SLS, the Space Launch System Artemis 1 test, while that launch took place. And that launch that took place was the first all commercial crew of four people to launch, to go to the International Space Station. They have done a flight before with four people on the Dragon spacecraft launched by the Falcon 9 rocket, but that time it did not go to the space station. This time they got an approval, and the company that's doing this is called Axiom. Axiom is a relatively new company. A few years back, they proposed, and NASA accepted the idea of them building their own module, and eventually it will be three different modules that will be attached to the space station. And Axiom, once they have all these modules together, and eventually another piece sticking out of that with massive solar panels sticking out of it, would actually be a complete space station. So this way, in 2031 or so, when NASA starts to wind down on the International Space Station, this Axiom section could completely separate from the front of the space station. That's their goal, but they're not ready for the module, but they are ready with the people. Once their space station is free flying, they're going to send people up on a regular basis. But just to make sure they know what they're doing, they launched the crew up there, paid roughly $50 million each, that's four people, to SpaceX to put them, launch them, and dock with the space station, which was successful. This happened, Sunday, so it was Friday. And then they docked 21 hours later. Open the hatch. If you go on the internet, you can actually see a picture in the forward Harmony module that shows all 11 11 people that are presently on board the International Space Station. So you have three Russians, one guy from the European Space Agency, you got four Americans, and now you have these four people that just went up, docked with the space station. So now you have a total of 11. Temporarily, they're only up there for, it's a 10-day mission, so roughly 8 days on station. And one question I was asked me was, you know, where do they all sleep, you know? Sleeping quarters on the space station, for many years now, they've had in the Tranquility Module. It used to be in Unity, but they moved everything to the Tranquility Module, where you have four sleeping quarters there. Russia always had two. Now they have three because they, you know, a few months ago they launched the Nyoka Science Module, docked at the Russian portion of the space station. And in that module, they have everything, you know, from, you know, for science, but they also have another extra bathroom. They also have an extra sleeping quarters there. So now you have three on the Russian side. So that gives you seven right there. And then you have four more. Now, where do they go? Well, not too long ago, they set up an extra sleeping quarter in the Columbus module. That's the European Space Agency module. The space station has, you know, that's around 15 or 16 of these modules. And some are, you know, each one is a little is different, but supplied by different companies, different countries, like Japan has the Kaibo modules. Anyway, Columbus has Columbus is part of the European Space Agency system. They put that module up 3 years ago, and that's where one of our ham stations are. When they do contacts with schools, that's one of the places that they transmit from. And so there's an extra sleeping quarters in there, and then they're going to actually, they call it camping out, and they're going to find one other spot in that Columbus module for the other person. And you have one other person is going to sleep, they said, in the Dragon spacecraft itself. They have that option too, so, you know, one of those people could actually sleep there. And then there's another compartment where they could use, and that would be in the Quest Lab. The Quest Lab is the one that they usually use for, they always use for the American side and the European Space Agency side. EVAs, the spacewalks, you know, you get Quest Lab is like two rooms, one big room, and then that's where they normally get traffic, but there are spaces on, and you move to a smaller room, and that's the airlock that they, you know, they would close the door, and then they would evacuate the air and enter space that way. Well, there's not going to be any spacewalks for the next, you know, 8 to 10 days, you know, from the American side. So they're able to have one guy in there. So that's where they're putting everybody. And I always found that interesting. And that's the story with those couple of launches. Any questions or comments before I go on? This is WS2N. The name here is Paul for the SpaceNet Report. Okay, nothing heard. One of the biggest topics on this net is the James Webb Space Telescope that was launched Christmas last year. And it, you know, took a couple months to about a month to get to the L2 Lagrange point 2, a million miles away from Earth, roughly four times the distance of the Moon. And that went through this complex system of opening up, this origami system of opening up the sunshades, which was as big as a tennis court, a little larger than 21-foot diameter gold mirror that had to be opened up, and naturally solar panels, and, you know, everything worked 100%, and it's still working. Haven't gotten any pictures back yet. They didn't expect to by this time because they've been getting it all ready. They've been aligning the mirrors, these 18 hexagonal shaped mirrors, gold shaped mirrors that they've been adjusting the last couple of months, trying to get all the light from, you know, they pointed it actually at one star and then readjusted these mirrors until they got all those lights, you know, make a perfect, you can see 18 dots, you know, centered in the air on the screens when they received it, and then they eventually put all 18 dots onto one single dot, and now it's all focused onto one dot. That's all worked out good, and now they've been getting the instruments, the four main instruments, you know, roughly in the infrared area that have to be adjusted to make sure that when it comes time for first light, everything works. And the three of the instruments, they don't need to get it. Everything has to be cold for infrared. So they'll bring it down to, like, you know, around 38, 40 degrees Kelvin. There's one instrument called the MIRI, M-I-R-I, the mid-infrared instrument. And the wavelength for the mid-infrared has to be colder than what they can get with the sunshade, you know, making sure everything is as cold as possible in that location of space. So they need to actually have a refrigeration system on board, which they have put into operation. We think of, you know, Freon 12 or you know, some refrigerant, maybe 134A or something for your car, you know, running through your refrigeration system to keep things cool. The space environment where James Webb Space Telescope is, they need to have a cascade type of system. One system bringing the temperature down, and they have another system that's making it go even lower. But as a refrigerant, they're using helium, so liquid helium, and that passes the restriction point, what they call that, the JT joint position, and at that point it expands, and it gets even, takes the heat away from whatever's in that area. In this case, the unit itself is about 30 feet away from the detector itself. The detector itself has to get down to roughly a little bit below 7 degrees Kelvin, which is why the minus 447 degrees Fahrenheit. But to do that, they have the detector, which is some kind of arsenic or probably gallium arsenic, CCD, a charge coupled device. That's really the detector. That thing has to get so low temperature to receive the infrared light to do that, they have that mounted on a copper, probably as big as your hand, as a fist of copper, and that's where the real cooling is taking effect. They get this copper, you know, the liquid helium. They want to expand into a gas. It's bringing the temperature down in that piece of copper so low that eventually you're going to get down to the proper temperature, which is really only going from like 40 degrees Kelvin down to 7 degrees Kelvin. But at that point, then the MIRI, the mid-infrared instrument, will work properly. And that's the one they really want to, you know, that will look actually furthest back in time than all of them. And I hope you get tremendous detail on that. And it looks like, so far, you know, all that is working. They have the helium system working. It's flowing right now. It's bypassing the copper block. And eventually, I think they're going to close the valve, probably very shortly, to close one valve. And this way, it stops, you know, taking that route. It won't take the bypass route anymore. It'll go directly to the this copper block, which has the detector on board. And we'll see how this goes next week, or probably the week after, when I see the results on the NASA website. And I'm sure it'll go fine. I mean, everything else has really gone 100% on this, I guess, $10 billion project, which probably, you know, took 20 years. But it's all gone well, and hopefully they get the first pictures back. Looks like I'm going to guess May, probably the end of May. Another month. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Nothing heard. NASA also does flights with airplanes. And they take equipment up to make, you know, test things, make sure it's going to work okay, you know, when they launch it into space. Anyway, they took something called the Airborne Lunar Spherical Irradiance System. They put this basically a camera that's going to take more of a photometer. Actually, it's going to take the light that's radiating from the moon in all the different phases, you know, crescent, and quarter, and half, and full. And they want to bring this plane up to, I think it's 70,000 feet or something, this plane will fly. And, you know, which is not, you know, over 90% of the, above the atmosphere. So, yeah, it's almost a vacuum up there. Not quite, of course, because, you know, it is an airplane, not a rocket. But it's high enough where they can get accurate measurements of how much light is coming off the moon. The reason they want to do that is NASA has probably about 20 different satellites, you know, going around the Earth, looking down at the Earth, you know, at all these different wavelengths, and they're constantly getting data back. And what they would like to do is calibrate them all 20 of them. They would like to make sure that everyone, you know, is starting from the same point when it's taking its reading. This way they can get a more accurate number. Well, by using this system, by taking this thing up to this atmosphere in this ER-2 aircraft, you know, NASA aircraft, and once they take all these readings, they'll be able to use that data and put that into all these, you know, into the data of all the satellites that are coming back, and I forget the percentages. Much bigger of a difference than, you know, of accuracy, although they're very accurate. This is going to refine the number down even more, which, you know, which helps for air pollution, water pollution, you know, all that, and then global warming, you know, they'll be able to get more information out of that with this particular camera and test. Apparently, from what I see, that's been going well, and they're going to keep flying up there every now and then to, the more they fly, the more accurate they're going to get the numbers. I think they said they'll get it down to 1% accuracy, you know, less than 1% accuracy. You know, less than 1% failure rate, I guess it is. Any questions? WS2N. Okay. Nothing heard. I talk about Perseverance all the time. Perseverance was the rover that went up last February, landed February 18th of last year. So now up there a little over a year. And that was pretty much a duplicate of the Curiosity rover. I mean, there's a lot more advanced equipment on the latest one because, you know, you have almost a 10-year difference in the instrument. So that was it. Now, flew on Perseverance. But Curiosity is still going strong. That's riding around a Gale crater. Perseverance is riding around a Jezero crater, different part of Mars. And Curiosity is, still doing good work. They're trying to bring it up higher and higher on Mount Sharp. Gale crater is where they landed, and Mount Sharp is located in Gale crater. Mount Sharp goes up over three miles high. They're not going to drive up 3 miles high, but they are trying to go to a much higher level than where they started. So as they're driving up, they came across all these different rocks, a field of rocks. They want to just keep going up higher. And they came to a grinding halt. They said, we've got to stop. Now, this Curiosity on Earth weighs around 2,000 pounds. The difference in weight on Mars like 0.38, like one-third of what we are on Earth. But it's still pretty heavy driving around on the planet with these metal wheels, thick metal wheels. And over time, with Curiosity, I noticed that the holes were developing in these wheels from all these sharp rocks. And they said, well, if we see sharp rocks anymore, we're going to find another path. And they came across this with cameras. They used different navigation cameras. There's 17 cameras on board Curiosity. And they used a mast cam. That's one that sticks about 6.5 feet above the surface of the planet. Looked at this field of rocks, and there was nothing but these sharp rocks. These are rocks that were eroded, apparently not by water, but by wind. They all have these sharp edges. So they've had experience with this. They know that, if they keep going and doing what they're doing, eventually these wheels are going to become useless. So they don't do that anymore. So they came to a grinding halt, and now they're planning a new route. They're going to back up, back to where they came from a couple of weeks ago, and then probably find another way around this to get to another area that the scientists want to investigate. And the wheels are still holding up, and Curiosity is the one. If you look at the wheels, the six wheels, and you see these holes, these actually square holes. Those were actually put in there by JPL when they built it. They're worn out from almost 10 years. I think in August will be 10 years riding around on Mars. But some of these square holes, if you look at them, it spells out JPL in CW in Morse code. You see it, you see that on every wheel. And why do they put it there? Well, they have navigation cams, they have all kinds of lasers, and they could tell from revolutions of the wheels, how far they've gone. But sometimes the wheels flip a little bit. And what they thought about over 10 years ago when they put these holes in the wheels were, as it drives around, it's going to hit some sandy spots. It's going to leave the impression of JPL, Morse code on the, they had it picked up, so they chose JPL. But, you could actually see the impression on the surface itself. So let's say the odometer on it for the spinning of the wheels showed one thing, and it was in a very sandy area. Maybe they didn't go, 10 meters. Maybe they only went 7 meters. Anyway, we would be able to verify that when they send pictures back down using the navigation cameras, and they would be able to know how far they went. They'd be able to calibrate things better too. Interesting enough, the advancements in all the latest technology, they know the amperage, they know the voltage, they know everything for each wheel, each of the six wheels. They didn't need to put the same holes on Perseverance. If you look at the two, that's one way. They kind of look the same. Perseverance is a little bit bigger and a little heavier. But, you look at a Quick, they all have they both have these big arms sticking out of it with all kinds of drills and things on the end. Roughly, kind of look the same. In the back, they have these big radiators sticking out. And why do they need the radiators? Because these things are nuclear-powered. They have RTGs on them, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, putting out around 109 watts of electrical power, and they use that to charge the batteries on a regular basis. And that's how these things work. That's why they can run them now, in Curiosity's case, almost 10 years. No problem. So, you can see these big radiated things sticking out of the back, and they kind of look the same. But one difference is if you look at the wheels, any of the wheels, if you don't see JPL and Morse code, you're looking at Perseverance and not Curiosity. Any questions or comments? WS2X.
NQ1U, John.
NQ1Q? No. John, what'd you call again?
In November, Quebec, one uniform.
You didn't get into this, and maybe you have in the past, but something's up there for 10 years. There's got to be a lot of dust storms. How do they keep the solar panels clean?
Yeah, well, that would be with the two previous rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, at the solar panels. Actually, the one right before that, that small one, it was about the size of a big microwave oven, was Sojourner, that had a solar panel too. That was a engineering test to see if it would all work, and that was in the mid-90s when that went up. But of course, these last two that we sent, Curiosity and Perseverance, we don't have any solar panels at all, John. They are, like I said, powered by plutonium-239. It's sitting in this RTG, this radioisotope thermoelectric generator. It's giving off heat. They surround the unit with these graphite-type blankets, and within those blankets they have thermocouples, a lot of thermocouples. Thermocouples, you probably know, is you heat it and you're going to get, with dissimilar metals, you're going to get a voltage out of it. So they have, I don't know how many of these thermocouples wrapped in these blankets, and they run in series and parallel, and then they come up with a voltage and an amperage. And of course, multiply that together, and you're going to find out the wattage in all these thermals. All these units are running a little over 100 watts. So the panels themselves, they don't have to worry about cleaning them because they don't have them. They did on Spirit and Opportunity. What would happen every now and then, you'd have this breeze, this light breeze would come by. Sometimes these dust devils, a couple of cases, and as it's these breezes would come by, the panels would sometimes clear off almost 100% in Spirit and Opportunity's cases. So they didn't have a problem with that. Spirit eventually got stuck in the ground with wheels. That was what, after about 6 years of operation, they went up, 2004, I think it was January, they went up roughly 10 days apart. When they land on Mars, one on one side of the planet, the other one on the other side of the planet. And Spirit eventually quit because its wheels eventually got stuck to the point where they couldn't move it. And the sun's rays were at an angle when I got stuck that they eventually they couldn't recharge the battery and they eventually stopped talking to us. Opportunity just